The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So the topic that I thought of talking about today was inspired by an exchange I had on Sunday with somebody. And I guess I could say that the title for the talk would be something like, Suffering is our guide. Suffering is our guide for our practice. So suffering is the word that is usually translated by the Pali word dukkha. And this exploration around suffering was the entirety of the Buddha's question that motivated him to understand his mind. He wanted to understand if it's possible to be free of suffering. He looked around the world and saw beings suffering even though they wanted to be happy. And he wanted to understand what was going on and whether it was possible. I think essentially he wanted to recognize, was there some aspect of that suffering that was able to be released internally? That, I mean, there's going to be conditions in the world always. And is it possible to be at ease in the heart no matter what the conditions in the world? And so I think that was really his exploration, this question of not necessarily how can I fix the world, but how can I be in relationship to the world such that the heart is not struggling with it? And that may not mean, that doesn't mean, in fact, it doesn't mean that we would simply sit and let the world be in chaos around us. That the opening to suffering that the Buddha found without constriction, I mean, the exploration of the suffering that can be released is really a kind of a constriction of our hearts and a constriction of our minds around controlling, fixing, resisting impermanence, wanting things to go the way we'd like them to go. And we might think that if we landed where we were at peace with the conditions in the world, that would mean we didn't take action. We might have the idea that peace means non-action, or ease of heart means non-action. But what happens as we release the constriction around suffering is that when we see suffering, the heart responds and resonates with it, and there's a natural movement in our system to want to act to alleviate suffering that doesn't come from constriction and pain and frustration and anger and hatred, but comes from compassion instead. And so this opening to releasing a relationship to suffering of contention, of conflict, doesn't mean that we'll just, oh, suffering's in the world. Okay, that's just things as they are. It's like if you were to see a child running out into the road in front of a car, you wouldn't just go, things as they are. You would try to get that child off the road. And that's the natural movement of compassion as it sees suffering either happening or about to happen, that there's this movement of action to alleviate it, whether that suffering is internal in our own systems or external. And so this teaching around dukkha, the teaching of suffering, there's different definitions to this word dukkha. And I just like to mention these three uses. There's three uses of the word dukkha in the texts. The first is this experience of reactivity, the way the mind resists and rebels against what's happening. This is really the suffering that the Buddha was pointing to that's possible to be released, this reactivity of mind. A second definition of suffering is a kind of inherent unreliability of experience as being a place where we can find lasting happiness. So, you know, we might think, our minds actually think around the experience of pleasant and unpleasant, our minds kind of orient around that to say, you know, this thing, I want this thing, I need to get this thing, and then I'll be happy. Or I need to get rid of this thing, I need to control this thing, or figure out how to not be in association with this unpleasant experience, and then I'll be happy. And there is a kind of happiness that comes with that, you know, that we do find some measure of ease in a moment of getting something that we want or getting rid of something that we don't want. But it's very unreliable. It lasts a very short time, that ease of the having or the ease of the getting rid of. It lasts a relative, sometimes very short, and sometimes, you know, may last a day or a few days even, coming and going, a sense of, oh, I figured that out. Yeah, I've got it in control. But something will happen at some point that will basically show us that we are not in control. And this is because the nature of the world, the nature of all experience, is it's impermanent. It's changing. There's no condition in the world that's going to last forever, so that we can land on it and say, that's it. That's what's going to do it for me. And so this is a second definition of this term dukkha, that because things are impermanent, there's a kind of inherent unreliability in the way that we have habitually thought about, how can I be happy? So that's another definition of dukkha, is unreliable experience. All experience is unreliable. Now, this kind of dukkha is not going to disappear. You know, this definition of dukkha is basically a kind of almost a statement of, this is the nature of the world, of our experience. It is inherently unreliable. That doesn't mean that we have to suffer about it, though. But what I'd say is that our suffering, the suffering that the Buddha discovered that's possible to transform, comes because we resist this unreliability, because we want things to be reliable. We feel like there's a problem that it's not reliable. And somehow it's either my fault that I'm not able to make something reliable and have a lasting happiness, that I'm at fault, or we feel like the world is at fault, that there's somebody to blame out there, or just, you know, nature is against me somehow. And so we resist this truth of unreliability rather than simply acknowledging it as, yes, this is a truth. This is the way it is. And seeing if we can maybe become kind of in alignment with that truth. Explore the possibility of aligning ourselves with that truth instead of fighting it or trying to control it. And again, as we come into alignment with that truth, it doesn't mean that we aren't acting, that we just give up. That's, you know, that idea that we would give up is based on a kind of a habitual belief that's associated with wanting and aversion, that is telling us, or has the belief underneath it, that getting what I want is what's going to be happiness. Getting rid of what I don't want is what's going to be happiness. That wanting and aversion have this view that the only way we do things, the only way that anything happens, is because of wanting and aversion. That if we didn't want something, we would never do anything. That's a belief that wanting has. And what I'll point to here is that the wanting that creates suffering, again, it's got that kind of neediness to it. It's a stickiness. We feel a suffering around, we can start to feel a suffering around wanting in our hearts. We definitely feel the suffering around aversion in our hearts. The suffering of wanting is a little harder to see. I talked about that some last night. There is a suffering associated with wanting and aversion. And as we begin to explore wanting in our experience, we see that a piece of it has this kind of constricted pain quality to it. It feels sticky, it feels resistant, it feels holding, clingy. And that quality feels like the heart is not available to be receptive. It's like instead of having a heart that's kind of like the jello analogy. It's kind of like a resonating jello mass of, you know, meeting the world that, you know, if something comes through jello, it doesn't really destroy it. It may kind of mush through it. And that's kind of how our hearts can be. But mostly our hearts are more like this fortress. They're hard and constricted. And so as we begin to explore wanting and aversion in our experience, particularly wanting, we may begin to see that hardness of heart that is painful. That suffering, that hardness of heart is suffering. And the there's a piece of wanting that may not have that hard quality, that is more related to a movement to respond out of compassion, or a movement to offer out of generosity. And so there is a form, we could say, of wanting or of desire or of movement towards action that comes with some of these qualities of compassion, of generosity, of wisdom, of kindness. There's a movement towards action, but it feels very different than that kind of constricted quality around wanting or aversion. And so this is an exploration that we make. You know, yesterday, after I talked about wanting, somebody said to me, but aren't there like wantings that are helpful? And yes, there are wantings that are helpful. And yet they're often so obscured or mixed up with this kind of wanting that's not helpful. And so beginning to be curious about wanting, we may begin to find our way to that wanting that's more supportive, or more, we could say, responsive instead of reactive. Responsive instead of clinging. That it feels more like the heart, that jello of the heart is rippling and resonating in response to something, and naturally wants to respond, as opposed to gotta fix, gotta change, gotta control, manipulate, a kind of a hardness of heart. And so this experience in the heart is one of the places that I look at in terms of this response to the truth of unreliability. This truth of, yes, there is, experience is unreliable inherently. There's no place really to land. And so we acknowledge that as a truth and explore our reaction, our relationship to that truth. And then the third definition of dukkha is unpleasant experience. The word for, we talk sometimes about when something's unpleasant, we don't like it, we don't want it, we want to push it away. Or something's pleasant, we like it, we want to have more of it. Well, the word that's used in the Pali for that unpleasant or pleasant, the word is dukkha for unpleasant and adukkha for pleasant. So it's connected to this word that's translated as suffering, but in this case it has a different meaning. It means just the pleasant, unpleasant aspect of our experience. And then there's a third aspect of experience that's kind of neutral. It's the understanding in Buddhist psychology is that any experience that arises is going to have one of these three flavors to it. It will either be pleasant, it will be unpleasant, or it will be neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And so it will be adukkha nasukha, something like that. Neither pleasant nor unpleasant. And so that's just, again, also a given. Like the unreliability of experience, this changing nature of experience to be this flow between pleasant and unpleasant experience is going to happen. And that is something that is not, that itself, the unpleasant experience is not itself that kind of suffering that the Buddha was pointing to as being something that can be released. He pointed to, actually, he said, of his monks, the people who have deeply understood freedom. He said, they experience pleasant, unpleasant experience. And an ordinary run-of-the-mill person, a person who's never had any kind of mental training, will experience pleasant and unpleasant experience. And what's the difference between the two of them? They both experience pleasant and unpleasant. What's the difference? And he said, well, the difference is that when an ordinary person who hasn't had any training meets unpleasant experience, they react to it. They say, woe is me. Why me? What's wrong with me? How can I fix this? How can I get rid of this unpleasant experience? When somebody who's had training in the mind, who's released from suffering, this the first kind of suffering I talked about, when they experience unpleasant experience, they experience unpleasant experience. It stops there. This is an unpleasant experience. It's arising. There's not a kind of a reverberation in the heart around it. It's just, oh, this is unpleasant. And then understanding of the naturalness of unpleasant experience to arise. Again, we have this idea that somehow life shouldn't give us unpleasant experience. And yet this, again, is just a very natural unfolding. Like the unreliable nature of experience, the pleasant, unpleasant, neutral nature of experience is just a fact of life. So when the Buddha pointed to suffering that can be released, and the suffering I'd like to point to is a suffering that can be a guide for us, it's this first kind of suffering, the kind of suffering where we are fighting against this nature, the nature of unreliable, and the nature of this flow of pleasant, unpleasant experience, where we're struggling against that. So this is the part that the Buddha pointed to as this can be released. So it's another teaching that the Buddha offered around this kind of suffering. It's first that it exists and that it's useful to recognize it. And as we begin to see it, this first kind of suffering, we begin to see that it is not inherent, that kind of response of our heart to be constricted. It doesn't have to happen. It does happen for all of us because of our conditioning, because of the way that we have been responding to suffering through our lives, and because of very human tendencies to when we experience pleasant, to kind of go for the quickest hit of happiness. Get that pleasant? We learn this from moment one when we're born. Ah, go for the food. That feels good. Cry when I'm unhappy. I get some response. We learn from very early on that we can get some measure of relief from our discomfort through this wanting and aversion. And we're not even thinking about it. It's kind of a very natural movement. All life has this kind of tendency to move towards the pleasant and away from the unpleasant. Even a single-celled organism, an amoeba, will move towards food and away from chemicals that would damage it. So there's this kind of natural tendency to move towards pleasant and away from unpleasant. That natural tendency towards that comes partly in our experience because we do get that little moment of, oh, a little bit of relief here. A little bit of relief when I get something I want or get rid of something I don't want. And basically we learn that that's a kind of happiness, that's a kind of feeling good. And through our life we've been conditioned basically to think that's as good as it gets. That's the best kind of happiness there is. If I can just line up all these little moments of getting what I want or getting rid of what I don't want, that's as good as it can possibly get. And by the way, we feel ourselves to blame if we aren't able to do that. You know, somehow I'm failing if I'm not able to do that. So the way we've been conditioned through life is towards that pleasant, away from that unpleasant, and we think that the little bit of happiness we get there is the best that it gets, and so that conditions more of that action. We do more of that. oh, well, the last time I was happy was when I got what I wanted, so let me do that again. Let me find something to want. So the movement of our mind in that way is not hardwired in us as human beings. And there is actually a deeper kind of ease and peace that's possible than simply getting what we want. And in fact, this, I think, is points to what the Buddha said at the when I said that, you know, at the early in his exploration, he had this kind of reflection. People are trying to be happy, but they end up suffering. And part of that is because of this pattern that we've habituated ourselves to wanting something makes me feel a little bit of happiness, so let me want to want. Getting rid of something makes me getting rid of something unpleasant makes me feel better. So let me find something unpleasant in order to get rid of it. And so we find ourselves basically on this pattern of basically looking for the pleasant and looking for the unpleasant in order to hold it or get rid of it, as opposed to kind of resting in the field of recognizing pleasant, unpleasant comes and goes. And so we've habituated ourselves to that pattern. And yet, and we haven't seen the possibility of another way to happiness, another avenue to happiness, which we can begin to see through our practice, and by beginning to not buy into the beliefs around wanting and aversion, those beliefs that say, this is what's going to make me happy. If we can hold that aside for a little while, And instead of saying, instead of buying into, I need to follow through on this wanting in order to be happy, we instead get curious and turn towards the wanting. What's this experience of wanting? What's this experience of aversion? Turn towards it and hold it, neither trying to tell yourself, get rid of this wanting, get rid of this aversion, but neither buying into its story. We begin to be able to see the changing nature of that pleasant and unpleasant experience. We begin to see, oh, that unpleasant experience ends. This wanting itself can end. The aversion can end. When the thing that I want kind of vanishes from my field of vision, and this I've seen so many times. So many times I've seen, you know, the mind kind of moving in the direction of, oh, I want that thing. You know, see something and see a Starbucks and think of a latte. And, you know, the mind kind of, oh, want that latte. And so one case I was driving and I was stopped at a stoplight and there was a Starbucks on the other side of the street. And I was sitting there with that field of seeing the Starbucks and, oh, that latte, it kind of grew in my mind. But I was just watching it and just watching the wanting. And I committed myself. I'm not going to follow through on that one. It was so tempting because all I had to do when I turned the corner was just go into the Starbucks. But I decided to drive past the Starbucks. So light turned green. I turned the corner, drove past the Starbucks. And as soon as the Starbucks was out of my field of vision, the wanting went away. It's like as soon as it got too hard or it was way more energy to turn around, wait at another light, make a U-turn, as soon as it was like too much, it's like the mind just let it go. And you can see as you watch things like the wanting, as you watch wanting and aversion in your experience, you see when the wanting goes away, the suffering goes away. When the aversion goes away, the suffering goes away. So this is something that we can begin to explore. So as we begin to get curious about this first kind of suffering, this kind of reactivity to the unreliability, this reactivity to the pleasant unpleasant, we begin to get familiar with the fact that it's our mind that is adding something. It's adding a kind of a resistance or a holding to, and that is the suffering that can be released. We are not going to be able to change the conditions of the world completely. There are definitely actions that we can take that, I mean, I do think that participating in social justice movements is worthwhile. You know, that this can change conditions in the world. And yet that action can happen instead of out of anger at the injustice, out of compassion and care and generosity for offering your time. So the exploring the suffering in our experience, we are starting to see what part of the suffering. We begin to distinguish these three kinds of suffering, I would say. We begin to recognize which part of the suffering is created by our minds. And we begin to recognize, yes, there's this unreliability. Wow, you know, and uncontrollability. That's another flavor of this. We see, you know, that this changing nature of experience, the uncontrollability in large measure of what's going on, and that when we are in resistance to these truths of impermanence, unreliability, uncontrollability, then our being is all kind of tied up in knots. And when our heart can let go of that resistance to those truths, begin to recognize what part is extra in relationship to those truths, then we begin to see the navigation of unreliability and uncontrollability can happen in a completely different way. And so we begin to see the suffering that is of interest here in our exploration is the suffering that is created in our minds. This is the only place there's any measure of control. We cannot change other people's minds. We cannot make other people do what we want them to do. And there's actually only a little bit of maneuvering room in our own experience. But that maneuvering room comes through mindfulness, comes through being available and able to recognize, oh, this is suffering that's arising. When with mindfulness we can see, oh, this is the mind reacting to experience, then there's a different choice that can be made instead of following through on it and just re-cementing that pattern of aversion or that pattern of wanting. A different thing can happen that allows space for us to recognize these truths of unreliable, this changing nature of experience, and begin to recognize what kind of dukkha is something that can be released and what kind of dukkha is just kind of the natural flow of experience. The nature of unreliability, the nature of changing, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And this means basically that this mindfulness is used, the mindfulness is used to understand, to look at and to explore, understand our suffering. That understanding begins to tease apart these different flavors. What's controllable, what's unreliable, and what is our reaction to that? And so when I say to use our suffering as a guide, I would say that anytime we're suffering, it's a pointer to ways that we are not aligned to these truths. Anytime we are feeling suffering, anytime we're in kind of a reactive mode, we're feeling anger or hatred or confusion or fear or even things like pride or desire or anxiety or boredom, you know, all of these kind of experiences where we feel like things are off. And that's actually maybe one of the best translations for dukkha. Things feel off. Suffering sounds like a big thing. But this dukkha goes from the subtlest kind of, things are kind of eh. Just not the way I'd like it to be. It's okay. You know, kind of with that tone. It's okay. But not, it's okay. It's just fine. It's okay. Kind of with a spin to it. The subtlest kind of that is a form of suffering to the screaming rage. So dukkha spans that range. And so anytime we're feeling any kind of offness, we are not in alignment with these truths of unreliable, uncontrollable, impermanent. And so when we are suffering, it's kind of pointing us in some way, it's pointing us to there's something true that the mind isn't quite able to open to here. We're resisting one of these truths in some fashion. And so when we are suffering, there is a, and the exploration is not to try to dive through and say, what is it that, how can I see this as unreliable, but rather to almost honor the suffering and say, this is the reaction of this human being in this moment to unreliability or uncontrollability. It's very natural. We are very conditioned this way. And so this is what's so amazing to me about the Buddha, that he could articulate this about us as human beings, that we tend to react to uncontrollability, impermanence, unreliability as human beings. It's a very natural thing. And yet it's not hardwired. The Buddha found a way to where the mind can be at ease with these truths. And the way to that is through meeting the suffering. And so anytime you're suffering, it's like it's a pointer to some kind of truth. And then I would say also that when we are suffering, it's also a pointer to kind of that resistance that we have, the resistance we have to unreliable, uncontrollable, impermanent, is related to a deep, deep wish that's also very natural as human beings, to have ease, to be happy, to be safe. That wish to be happy, to be safe, to have ease is at its deepest level an expression of metta, of love. And that love is for ourselves, for all beings. At its deepest level, our systems have this wish for well-being for ourselves and others. And that deepest wish of well-being is kind of butting up against these truths of impermanent, unreliable, uncontrollable. And our conscious mind, our habitual mind, the way that we've been conditioned is these things can't both exist simultaneously. It's like, they butt up against each other. It's like, well, if things are uncontrollable, then I can't be safe. And so I shouldn't want to be safe. And so we kind of denigrate, perhaps, in a way, as we butt up against this truth of uncontrollable or unreliable, we may feel like, then I shouldn't want to be happy. I shouldn't want to be safe. I shouldn't have that wish. But that wish at its deepest level is a very wholesome movement of heart to connectedness and care for ourselves and our fellow beings. And so it's not going to disappear. And so what is asked for when we are experiencing suffering, it's kind of like we're both having a pointer. We get a pointer. So the guide that suffering offers us is back to, if there's a thread in that suffering, that some kind of resistance to truth, to resistance to impermanent, unreliable. And there's also a thread in that suffering back to the deepest level of wish of well-being, of metta. And that suffering, I think I talked about this maybe in here a few weeks ago, the suffering is kind of like a tangle of those two things. That they get all mixed up. That the knot, the pain of suffering, is a tangle between that wish for well-being and the truths of impermanent, unreliable. And the way suffering can be our guide is that it when we are suffering, that suffering itself is composed of that, the tangle of threads, both of the truths, the unreliable, impermanent nature of experience, and this wish for well-being. It's not that the suffering is anything else. The suffering is the tangle of those things. I like this tangle analogy. It's really been helping me to describe this. It's like we think that the suffering is inherently bad or wrong. But what the suffering is this tangle. And if we were to, like, say, let me cut that tangle out, it's like, we can't cut the tangle out because it's composed of this tangle of threads of truth and love. And so the mindfulness, basically, it's almost like a solvent. It creates a bath in which these threads can get a little looser and begin to untangle themselves. And then we can start to see how these two sides, the love and the truth, can coexist. And we don't have to fight that. We don't have to feel like either the truth is wrong, like somehow feeling betrayed by the world because it's impermanent, unreliable. It's like, no, that's the world. It's just, that's the way it is. Or to feel like there's something, something ineffectual about the love. That the love is actually a way that we can meet that. When these come together, you know, that the love can meet those truths with a whole different feeling in the heart. And so we have to explore understanding suffering. We don't get to untangle the tangle without feeling the pain of the knot. And it's the tightness of the knot. I think that's another good way that the analogy is useful, this tangle analogy, because it's the tightness, the stuckness, the tangle, the tightness of the threads that creates the pain, not the threads themselves. And so the mindfulness gives us the tools that can loosen those threads. And so anytime, sometimes, there's a kind of a new age teaching that's something like, you know, we get the lessons we need in this life, and, you know, almost as if the world is, the universe is somehow, you know, creating these lessons for us to run up against. We do get the lessons we need in our world, in our lives, in our experience. But it's not because the world is somehow deciding what to put in our path. It's because what we meet in the world is our own minds. We get the lessons we need because we are meeting the world with our own minds and the ways that our mind reacts and rebels against its experience. And so we get the lessons we need because we are meeting how our minds are reacting to the world. I'm going to stop there. I had a couple more pieces I wanted to offer, but I think I'll just stop and see if there's any comments or questions. Yeah, and use the mic. So, Randy, would you get the mic?
A couple things. Yes, it seems to be on. One is, it was interesting to me that in Pali and English, the main word and the derived word on pleasant and unpleasant are the opposite. I mean, in English, the main word is pleasant, and then the modified word
is unpleasant.
Unpleasant,
and it's the
Pali,
opposite.
It's the other way around.
That's
the main
right.
word is dukkha, and then the modified word is adukkha.
Not unpleasant,
okay.
Or not painful, basically.
Okay. It struck me as ironic. The other thing is, when you're talking about how we tend to take the blame for something, I somehow flash to, I remember reading, there's this phenomenon that when children are 7 or 8, if their parent gets sick or dies, the child has sometimes develops a tendency to think it's their fault, that they think that the parent has gotten sick and died because they don't love them anymore, because the child thinks it's because they've done something wrong, and they tend to take the blame.
And again, that's a kind of a natural human tendency.
Right. So this is just...
It's a natural human tendency, but it's a... I would call it software rather than hardware. You know, it's very been very conditioned into us to, if something goes wrong, how am I at fault? What have I done wrong? And I think there's some usefulness to that in terms of navigating the world. You know, in terms of being human beings and surviving all of what has happened to us. That some measure of where did I make a mistake, what did I do wrong, has been onward leading in terms of evolution, and yet it is something that we can so it's not like hardwired in our mind, but it is something that we can recognize.
It's something we can modify.
It's modified through seeing the. Essentially, you know, with that kind of a situation, and we could just extrapolate it to something that happens in the world. You know, something goes on, and you know, we feel like, oh, I'm to blame, and we might begin to, with mindfulness, feel into that feeling of I'm to blame, and begin to recognize there's aspects of this situation that I participated in, and aspects that I need to own. Or aspects that this being created, you know, that this being responded in that situation was not helpful, and yet there were also a whole bunch of things that were out of control, and so that exploration begins again, point us to where are we making choices in relationship to the world, and where is there not capacity?
It's tricky because there's certain guilt trips that are crippling, and then others ways in a sense of guilt can lead to growth and better functioning.
And this is a really important exploration, you know, to begin to distinguish between those two. What I would say is that they're so close. and the Buddha actually had a couple of words for the wholesome one. And they were, I will translate them the way Tanisaro Bhikkhu did, conscience and concern. Conscience and concern, which is like the mind recognizing conscience being, this being did something to create harm. There's a mind that says, oh, it hurts to have created suffering. And that's wholesome. It helps us to recognize, you know, our system is essentially designed to feel suffering when we create suffering, so that we move in the direction to not create suffering. And yet we have all kinds of structures that are built on top of that, and we, you know, sometimes when we feel that kind of movement of, oh, this being created some suffering, that hurts, we may create justifications. Well, they deserved it anyway, or really they're to blame, or, you know, so, you know, we may go that direction, as opposed to allowing ourselves to recognize, oh, this is how it feels when this being has created suffering. So that's one aspect the Buddha pointed to, is that when we do something that creates harm, our heart will feel that. And I think of that almost as our moral compass. And when our heart is not constricted, but in that kind of jelly-like way, we feel a quivering. It feels like, yeah, this is like, this feels off that I've created suffering. And so that feeling of conscience may not be pleasant, but it is an onward leading. It's helping us to recognize doing that doesn't feel right. There's some offness to it. The other side, the concern side, is knowing or recognizing some action I may take in the future will create suffering. So it's having that capacity to model or to recognize this action would create harm, and oh, don't want to do that, don't want to go there. So that's the side that's the conscience and concern is the side that is worth opening to and learning from. And what I've seen in my own experience is that they're so close. The feeling of that is so close to the feeling of guilt and shame. And so it's like, it's so quick when you feel that, oh, this is what it likes to create suffering, to feel like, oh, I'm bad, I'm wrong, I'm a failure, I shouldn't have done that, or they're to blame, you know. So it's so quick to slip into that. And so it's really an interesting edge to begin to explore. And to me, the slipping into that, I'm bad, I'm wrong, I'm to blame, or somebody else is to blame, it's, again, it comes back to that feeling of hardening. It feels like a hardness. And the other side where, oh, this is what it's like to have done some harm, there's more of a feeling of the heart is more like jelly. It's more like resonant, and it's feeling the suffering.
Based on that resonance.
Yes.
Because if you just go with shame, then it's just on the level of ego, really.
Yes.
When you try to get rid of the shame, you're still doing it on the level of ego. But when there's based on that sense of resonance and
yes, and so
that's
an interesting piece in terms of suffering as a guide around something like shame. It's like we might again, it's this tangle, right? It's a tangle, and it's a resistance to something, and it's a resistance to having created harm, basically. And so if we can open and acknowledge that, it's like, oh, this is what it's like to have created harm. So right in there, right in that feeling of shame is a place where we can begin to recognize the wholesome side and the unwholesome side. And that's our work, is to begin to recognize, you know, how are we being reactive in that moment? Other comments or questions? Yeah.
There's this concern, doubt, hindrance, but something saying, how do you know if you're just putting up denial to something, then you don't want to go there, you don't want to think about it? That, I mean, it, I guess I'm working through my own answer to this. It's like you have to feel into it where you're, if you're closing off, oh, I don't want to feel the shame and guilt, don't go there. That's not wholesome to be in that.
Well, I mean, I think we need to recognize when there is a feeling of don't go there. There can be times, I mean, everything can be open to with mindfulness, including don't want to go there. So that kind of now, what often happens with the don't want to go there is we kind of don't want to go there, and then we flee. What we can do is hover with the, wow, don't want to go there. You know, just that, this is what it feels like to be on that edge of not wanting to acknowledge something. And it may be, so that's kind of a layer over what it is that's wanting to be acknowledged, or maybe that is kind of bubbling under the surface. Sometimes that not wanting to go there is a kind of a, it can be a kind of a protective mechanism for us in a way that, you know, it's like sometimes there's a wisdom to that don't want to go there right now, because if we push into it, we may find we're just exploding and lost in it. And so, you know, sometimes that movement of denial, it's also, I mean, it's when we're in that place, it's not to say we should deny and then like let it be like that, because let it be like behind our backs, but to acknowledge, yeah, that there's this feeling of not wanting to go there. That's what's happening right now. Then there's a kind of a respect for that part of the mind that's, you know, there's something going on there. And that denial itself, that feeling of, ooh, the fear, the resistance, the confusion, whatever, that's what's asking to be seen at that moment. Not whatever it is we're resisting or denying. So whatever the layer is that's kind of on the surface, that's what we open to. And so we don't have to try to stop the denial, but open to it. So, okay, this is what's... This too can be known with mindfulness. This feeling of... A feeling of putting up a wall. That's what's going on. Okay. I can know that. We maybe have time for one more, if there's another question. I'll say one more piece that I was going to bring in earlier. I think I can do this in 3 minutes. So to speak to denial a little bit in some ways, there are times when something happens in our experience. You know, maybe we do something. So this can also relate to the creating harm in the world. You know, that if we do something that creates harm. And yet, when we look at our hearts, it's like, well, I didn't intend to create harm there. You know, there wasn't any desire to create that harm. That's actually useful in terms of beginning to tease apart the shame from the feeling of, oh, harm was created from that action. So to recognize that what was the intention? What was the underlying intention in doing that action? And so there are times when our intentions are really good. We intend to do something that's helpful. And yet what we see is that disaster happens or some kind of pain results. Now, a kind of a key here is not to just say something like, well, okay, I'm not to blame for this because I didn't intend for bad to happen. So whatever suffering that person is experiencing, is that's their karma. You know, that's their fault. They have to work with that. I'm fine. No problem. I did not intend to create that suffering, so it's your thing. You deal with that. That might be something that we would kind of head towards with that recognition of, oh, I had a helpful intention, but it created harm. What the Buddha asks us to do in one teaching to his son at a very young age, at the age of 7, was to check in about our actions before, during, after acting, and see, has suffering been created? Is suffering going to be created? You look beforehand. If you know suffering is going to be created, don't do it. While you're acting, is suffering happening? If so, stop. After, check and see, did suffering happen? If so, then try to understand what happened. And so, and make amends for that. Undertake restraint in the future, it said in the text. And so what I'd like to point to, if we see that there's not an intention towards creating harm, and we see that harm is created, there may be something that needs to be understood there. So the suffering of others can be our guide as well. You know, something about the conditions that we didn't understand that we can learn from to help us not make that mistake again in the future, or not create that particular suffering in the future. So we don't have to take it there may be no way that I could have done another action, but to learn from that, not just to say, oh, it's their doing, but to suffering happened. What needs to be understood from that? So what can be learned? So that's another thing, is that not only our own suffering can be our guide, but the suffering of others can be a guide for us as well. So that we should stop with that. So, thank you.